I will start the recording and start the PowerPoint. Play from start. Hurrah! So here we are, Kabbalah, Genesis and Exodus, part 6. And this is all about what Joseph Campbell calls the hero's journey. And the hero's journey basically means that as you climb the Kabbalistic tree of life, or as you just grow in your own personal spiritual work, you have to come out of the tribe, away from the family's thinking, away from the vessel, the foundation, the yesod in Kabbalah. And you have to move on up the tree. We'll look at a diagram of that in a minute or two, so that you can individuate, become truly yourself, because that is the aspect of you that is of use to the Holy One. The tribal us is not of much use because it's absolutely immersed in our current laws and feelings and social mores, what one should do and what one shouldn't do. So the hero's journey is something every human has to do at some stage. If we're talking about reincarnation, at one of your lives, you're going to have to take the hero's journey, whether or not it's this life. It will happen at some point. And lots of the pictures today come from a book I had as a little girl, which is called Moses, Prince and Shepherd. So they're probably breaking copyright right, left and centre, but please don't sue me. So remember, we were talking about two versions of the Hebrew Testament. There are more of that, but the primary two ones are the E-text and the Y-text. The E-text is the older one, and that is the text that was written during the time of the first temple, and the second version was written at the time of the second temple. The Moses story seems to refer to the second temple, but all the way through it's also got a lot of first temple stuff in it. The two are definitely woven together, but it's absolutely fascinating to spot the little hidden treasures in there. And I often wonder whether the people who put the text together, the Torah together, were mystics and did value something of the first temple and therefore put it there hidden in plain sight. That seems to me to be a logical reason why there are these little windows peeping through, and we'll see a couple of those tonight, which are really rather beautiful. Now, the first temple did focus on divine masculine and divine feminine. And it had cereal sacrifice in the temple, but it became associated with the very prevalent way that was working in the Middle East in those days, in the other religions, which sacrificed the firstborn son. And of course, we've got an immediate parallel here in the 10 plagues of Egypt. The last one was the death of the firstborn. So I don't know why those two work together or how they work together, but I think it's relevant to just sit and think on that and say, this is the end of the sacrifice of the firstborn. This is a final saying of God will sacrifice the firstborn of the pagan, if you like. So it's a little bit tribal in that regime. But for the temple, it becomes the animal sacrifice. Now, in Moses' temple, version of the temple, there is animal sacrifice. In the first temple, there wasn't. There was bread and wine, just as they have in the Christian communion. Now, does it actually matter about these two stories? Well, I think it does, especially if you're working with the oral tradition, which we are in Kabbalah, because they give you more insights and they give you a wider picture. And they also authorize you to be okay talking about angels and the divine feminine, because Orthodox views of Torah are not that generous, frankly. So let's have a quick look at this idea of angels, which were represented a lot more in the First Temple writings and are present in the E-text and also in the Jubilees text. Quite a lot of the Dead Sea Scrolls references angels. And the book 1 Enoch, which is one of the very early texts we know, is definitely an E-text. And there are four classes of angels referred to. The angels of the presence, which were the ones right in the heart of the temple, angels of sanctifications, which are angels of ritual, and even today, even if Jews and specifically Christians don't realize that there is an angel of sanctification responsible for the Mass, And that angel has many auxiliary angels that work in the Catholic or the Protestant Mass. And you can feel them when you do the actual sanctification of the calling down of grace for the sanctification of the bread and the wine. When you go, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, heaven and earth. I can't remember it now, of course. I say it so often and it goes out of your brain without the text in front of you. But you hold your hand up to draw the presence of the Lord. And this is an angel of sanctification. It's called presence, but it's not an angel of an actual temple or an actual church, because angels have one job and they do it perfectly. Also referenced in these earlier texts were guardian angels, which people talk about a great deal. These were utterly acknowledged to exist in the ancient days, and angels of nature, which we would call naiads and dryads and devas. And it's lovely when we do get little crystallizations of the early texts to see these angels, because there's something that we may need to come back to in the modern world with ecology the way it is. And Margaret Barker, one of my teachers, Dr. Margaret Barker, thinks ecological religion is absolutely vital now, because without that drive of understanding that God is in the very heart of nature through the angels, we won't choose to re-sanctify it. So a fulfilled human, a human that reaches the level of Messiah, such as Jesus, or probably Moses or Esther, would become half human, half angel. And the first one of those is said to be Enoch, who walked with God in Genesis, and he's now known as Metatron, the angel of the veil. So he stands at the place just before you can access the divine completely, in a kind of way of saying, are you worthy to come through here? And Metatron is responsible for human evolution. But the idea is also that they thought that the high priest had reached that level, was meant to represent them at that level. So the high priest was half human, half angel. So the high priest was allowed to do a lot of things that ordinary humans weren't allowed to do, and which might even have laws against them, because some of the laws were incredibly sensible, because messing with magic is extremely dangerous. The high priest had something called the Umim and the Thummim, which don't quite understand what they are, but they were tools of divination, which came on a breastplate with 12 different precious cabochon stones. And he used to use these for divination to find out what was what and what was needed. And this, of course, was totally forbidden to everybody else. But, of course, divination can be very, very dangerous. And fallen angels, these come, the legend, we see this in Isaiah of, oh, how art thou fallen, O Lucifer, son of morning. And the whole oral tradition and the legends about the first fallen angel who said he would rather rule in hell than serve in heaven. And the fallen angels, whether or not they became human or not, are said in the oral tradition and 1 Enoch to have been those who mated with the earliest humans, creating sort of half human, half giants called the Nephilim. You've actually come across those in things like the Russell Crowe movie about Noah, and they turn up here and there. And there's also other kinds of angels called archons and titans. The titans are absolutely neutral, and the archons are pretty much neutral. So people can draw a kind of neutral angelic presence to them and make it evil, according to the tradition. Now, Kabbalah is really useful because it holds us on structure. The Tree of Life on the left-hand side, and in the middle, there's the story, the journey. It's always the story that is the important thing. But if I move my cursor over the image on the right-hand side, we've got Malkut down here. That's the Sephirah here. Yesod is around the gonadic area, so that's beautifully covered, but absolutely shown in this icon. Tiferet is the upper body, which is ruled by the sign of Leo in astrology. And Hod and Netzach would be Mary and John. And Mary is on the feminine side and John is on the masculine side. Then we have Gevura, Hesed, which are the arms on the cross, and Christ's halo at Da'at. And we have Bina, an angel, and Chochmah, an angel. And here, the title. of Jesus Christ. No, what was it? Inri they put up. King of the Jews, that's right. So the structure is often shown by mystics who've done icons and things like that. And whenever you see an icon or anything like that, you can use it beautifully for meditation because it's just showing you the pattern of the universe. And the patterns of the universe are, well, primordial. They're there. They work. They're always going to be there. Now, all humans are said to be children of Adam Kadmon, the divine child. That's the world of Atzilut. That drawing on the left-hand side was done by Zev ben Shimon Halevi, and it's the letters that make the tetragrammaton, Yod Hei Vav Hei, Yahweh, in the pictorial image of a fiery man in the world of Atzilut. And the right-hand picture is a picture, an old icon of Metatron. So Judaic mysticism, acknowledges that we do get to be half human, half angel. And also one of the important things that Judaic mysticism teaches is that every single soul in the divine plan will perfect. Now, we don't know what other souls there are on other planets, but the universal task for those who are conscious of being conscious, which is a definition of a human or another race on other planets who don't know, we don't know about, which are also conscious of being conscious. And when you're conscious of being conscious, then you can become an anointed one. And every human eventually will get to that before the universe folds itself up and goes back to whatever it was before. So basically, even if there's 500 billion souls in the heavens already and one soul still down on a planet and we're all going, come on, Fred! The end won't happen until Fred also becomes messianic. So our job really is to work on ourselves, to be a light, to help others work on themselves, to help them along the path as well. But Kabbalah teaches humanity is approximately 2 years old. That's all. We're in the stage of tantrums and breaking our toys, and God understands that. So why was an exodus necessary, the biblical story? Well, for a start, it's the internal journey, which is important. But in the external world, Jacob's descendants who went to live in Egypt at the time of Joseph lost the connection with the higher world. And this is so easy to do in the tribe, especially when life is comfortable. There's an old saying you'll have heard of, which is there are no atheists in the foxholes. But when life is comfortable and easy, you don't need God. You don't need that calling. You don't need that reassurance. You don't need to ask for help. So it's very much easier when you're comfortable not to keep the connection going with the higher worlds. So Jacob's descendants sort of sank down to the level of vegetable man in this drawing of the tree of life here. So here, where I'm drawing it now, the three sephirot around Yesod, the ego, is where the tribe lives. And when you're there, you're out of touch with the self, and the self is the aspect that is part of the soul and in direct contact with divine communication. And there arose a new king who had not known Joseph, can be read on so many levels. It means there was a new pharaoh, for sure. But it also means a new king which became Mammon, if you like. Jesus said quite clearly, you cannot worship God or Mammon. God and Mammon. And Mammon doesn't just mean money. It means all the trappings of possessions and comfort and distractions and addictions and chocolate and alcohol and all these things. It's putting all of those as our sources of comfort. And they become our king. They become our ruler. Because we all in this modern world in systems which are purely addictive. We do live in a system which encourages us just to buy something or binge watch something to distract ourselves from our grief or our pain rather than looking for clear answers above. Now, this is an image of Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey, and it does sum up the Exodus beautifully. You've got the call to adventure. The call to adventure is when you feel that something isn't right in your life and you want to move on and you want to change and lift yourself up. And you can say that that would be Moses once he's been expelled, perhaps, from Egypt. We'll get to that part of the story in a minute. Then the supernatural aid that comes, that would be the burning bush. The threshold and the guardians, that would be the time where the odd bit in the Bible when it says the Lord tries to kill Moses, because there's obviously an issue going on there about whether Moses is actually fit to cross the threshold to go into this deep work. Also, the threshold in the Exodus itself refers to the crossing of the Red Sea, and that's the beginning of the transformation journey. Then there are mentors and helpers along the way that come along. Those would be the Lord leading the Israelites into the desert, and in Moses' case, it would be Aaron helping him and his sister Miriam. And the challenges and temptations, those go on. Whoops, moved it along. Accidentally there, I'll go back. And then we go to the abyss, which is the death and rebirth and the revelation, which would be the giving of the commandments. Transformation is the starting of the following of the law, which is also atonement. There's atonement at the time of the golden calf, for example. And then there's the return. The return is when you bring this back to the tribe, or in the case of the Israelites, you move on into the promised land and start building your temple. So the Exodus is a story of every human soul's growth. And the Israelites in Egypt have become in bondage to the physical world. And Pharaoh gets worried about them. And you see this in Britain in Brexit. There are too many of the foreigners. They're taking our jobs. They shouldn't be here. We don't want them. And Pharaoh said to his people, the Hebrews are more, they're reproducing faster than us, they're healthier than us, there's going to be more than us, them of us, and in the event of war, they could join up with the others and they could fight us, they could become terrorists. You can see that this language fits whatever the era. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them. They basically put them into slavery. And the Hebrews built for Pharaoh, we know the story there, building the pyramids for two pharaohs, actually, Pithom and Ramses. But the more the Hebrews were afflicted, the more they multiplied and they spread out. And the Egyptians were basically taught to fear them. And the Egyptians would beat them and hate them and made their lives bitter and even took away the straw from them for building the bricks for the stone that they had to build. But the Hebrews just went on doing it. So the king of Egypt said, right, the firstborn son, again, we're back to the firstborn, every son must be thrown into the Nile, basically drowned, like drowning kittens. But two particular midwives, and this is just representative because there would have been a lot more than two midwives for that multitude of people, but they're called Shipra and Pua, and they were given the task in the Bible of making sure that the sons were drowned or drowning them themselves at birth or making sure that they didn't live. And basically, Pharaoh called them before him and said, why isn't this working? Why aren't they dying? And the midwives who feared God, this is Elohim, first text, nearly all the teachings about the women are God Elohim texts. Most of the teachings about the men are Yahweh texts. So you can see that this is a mix and match then. And Pharaoh said to them, well, when you're helping the Hebrew women give birth and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, you shall put him to death. If it's a daughter, she shall live. And the midwife said, well, the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women. They're vigorous. They're fit. They give birth before we can get to them. They call us and they've already given birth to the child. And the Elohim was good to the midwives and the people multiplied. And because the midwives feared God, he established households for them, which is a way of saying that God was looking after them for not committing murder. And that was when Pharaoh said, every son must be thrown into the Nile, but every daughter you can keep. Now, Here's a picture of Jochebed, who's Moses' mother, and everybody knows the story of Moses being cast into the water in the basket, Moses in the bulrushes. And she placed him carefully in the rushes so the river wouldn't be taking him down or putting him into any danger. And of course, she in fact obeyed the order perfectly. She cast her son into the water. And we can see through these references of God and the actions of women, and on the next page you'll see that there's a triplicity, a trinity of women involved here. This is a sign of the drawing down of Shekinah, of the presence of the Holy One in the world. And Moses had two mothers, but there was also Miriam, which makes the three. The first one is called Jochebed. She's identified as called the Lord is glory, which is very interesting, that it is the Lord is glory rather than God is glory, but there you go. And she was also Moses' great aunt because her husband married his father's sister. And again, this happened a great deal in the Hebrew Testament. There was an awful lot of incest. They did not regard it as a problem in those days. She obeyed Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's daughter, she's not named in Genesis, but Jubilees, which is one of the earlier texts, 47:5, and Josephus, who's one of the chroniclers of the history of the Jews, call her Thamuthis, which is interesting because it's the Greek name for the Egyptian goddess of nourishment and the harvest. So they're basically saying that she was equated with Shekinah, she was divine. Depicted as having a cobra's head, which sort of brings us back to the serpent, which we'll be looking at later. This is a good aspect of the serpent. We have, of course, the serpent in Eden, and we're taught that it's evil. So Pharaoh's daughter goes to the Nile, sees the basket, opens it, and she has pity on him and knows full well that this is one of the Hebrew children who should be put to death. So she disobeys. Now, the basket itself represents a ship of the soul. It represents in our psyches the level of the soul. In the right hand, Jacob's ladder there, the soul is marked out in a pale gold. It's in the centre of the psyche, which is outlined in black. It's just above the crown of the physical, and it is the base of the spiritual world. Now, the spiritual word, Berea, is air. Or spirit, yet Sira is formation and water, and Asiya is the physical world of the body. So the soul rides above the physical world in the waters of Yetzira, filled with air, as a ship would be. As it sinks in the water, it stays afloat because of the air. So the basket represents the soul. And a clear soul for us can ride easily on the waters of Yetzirah, even though they may be stormy, because it's inspired from Berea, from spirit. Whereas a soul that is pulled down by the two green side triads of pain and of addiction and pleasure, or pulled down by physical reality, will be overwhelmed by negative belief and emotion. And the left-hand tree, I've sort of made a kind of butterfly there. You can see that the side triads are swollen. And this is what happens in most of humanity when we don't have access to the Holy One, is we get involved in our emotions and our fears and our cover-up actions and addictions. And we become obsessed with the law and obsessed with our philosophy and our religion. And they become more important than the pathway from Tiferet through the soul all the way up to the divine. So this is just symbolic of how we are meant to rise above the troubles. The idea that people want to metaphorically, figuratively, hopefully not literally kill us, but if we are working from the soul, we can rise above that and be saved, if you like, by inspiration, our angels, our guides, and the Holy One itself. So Moses is taken out of the water. Miriam, his elder sister, has stayed watching to see what happens to him. And she goes up to Pharaoh's daughter, who is wondering who's going to feed this baby, because she's decided she's going to keep it, goes up to her and says she knows a wet nurse who can help. And of course, everybody knows perfectly well that it's the mother of the child. And Pharaoh's daughter sends for Jochebed. So we have a trinity of three women being the angels, if you like, that ensure that Moses will survive and will be raised in the perfect way. He's raised as Pharaoh's daughter's son, so he's raised as a royal child in the palace, fully educated. He would have learned how to read hieroglyphics. He would have learned possibly how to read Greek. He might even have learned how to read Hebrew. He was certainly would have been able to speak both Hebrew and Egyptian. And Pharaoh's daughter would have allowed him, particularly through Jochebed, but because she was a spiritual being, to know and understand his origins. I would imagine that they kept them secret within that small group, that he was a Hebrew, but Moses knew it. He had safety, he had an identity, and he was surrounded by love. And these are the foundations that we need for a strong Yesod. And one of the reasons why our world is so polarized right now is because we have not had those foundations. Religion has much that is wrong with it, but the falling apart of religion takes away our moral compass, and we have not replaced it. So we're living in a world that does not have a solid moral compass, and that's the baby that's been thrown out with the bathwater. Now, from a strong foundation, a strong, powerful Yesod, we start to move up from the vegetable area across what's known as the liminal line here into the animal man area. We have to become my will, who I think I am, who I really am, as opposed to what society tells me I am. And then from there, you can actually individuate into your soul. But the animal man is the highest level of individuation within the physical world. It's whether you choose to become a politician, it's your career, it's the power you garner in the world. So Moses, as he grows up, knowing he's a Hebrew, tries to individuate and stand up for himself and his people. So he sees an Egyptian guard beating a Hebrew, takes up the whip and beats the guard to death. I don't suppose he meant to beat the guard to death, but he's done what nearly all of us do in this first attempt of individuation, even if we've had a sound childhood, is that we appear to other people to have gone off our rocker, because we are stepping out of the tribe and behaving and looking for different aspects. So Moses, unfortunately, well, actually, it's fortunate, because without that, he wouldn't have gone off into the desert and the whole of the rest of the story wouldn't have happened. But he realizes that he has overdone it and he's going to have to run. So Moses leaves Egypt because Pharaoh and the councils are going to have to punish him, probably kill him in return for what he's done, because he's identified himself with what they would regard as the enemy. And this is the thing about Yesod, it has to have enemies. It has to focus on the wrong being done by the other. It's not about us, it's about them. It's them who are the ones who are the problem. So Moses heads off out into the desert. Necessary suffering. I used to hate this idea when I was younger. As I get older and having been through some of that suffering, I can see how it hones you. We have to have our fall. We have to be thrown out of our Eden. We have to realize that our choices have consequences. So Moses has to go out into the wilderness. Jesus does the same. And the Israelites, once they leave Egypt, do the same. So Moses' story means he has to go to the wilderness. Then he has to take his people to the wilderness. And Jesus also had to go to the wilderness. This time of understanding that you are in many ways powerless. You give up your earthly power in order to be able to replace it with the greater spiritual power. So Moses is wandering out in the desert, well, it's not necessarily the desert, but it's outside the cities of Egypt on the borderlands. And he comes to a well. where the seven daughters, seven are the seven low Sephiroth of the Tree of Life, so that it's always relevant when there's a seven. A group of seven means that these are people who are under the governance of the three top Sephiroth, under the governance of spirit. So these seven shepherdesses, seven daughters of the priest of Midian, we'll come back to him in a minute, or the Cohen of Midian. Of course, Cohen in Judaism is the surname of the people who are of the priestly tribe. So a Cohen means a priest. The Cohen of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And other shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. So Moses helped these girls. And this is very slightly in parallel to the story of Rebecca at the well, when Eliezer went to find a wife for Isaac. Rebecca was at the well and drew water for Eliezer and his camels. So this time the outsider helps the women rather than the women helping the outsider. And they go back to their father and they say to him, "This man helped us." And he's given two names in Genesis, so I suspect this is both texts. First of all, he's called Reuel, and secondly, he's called Jethro. But he's clearly called both. The narrative follows on with Jethro, but the scribes have left Reuel in there. Reuel means the friend of God, not the friend of the Lord, but the friend of God, Elohim, and Jethro means the abundant one. And he's priest of Midian. Midian is the name of one of the sons of Abraham, and Keturah, his second wife, which Bill highlighted for us, could also have been another name for Hagar. Maybe after Sarah's death, Abraham returned, called back Hagar and Ishmael. But whatever, whether it's Hagar or Keturah, Midian was one of the sons of Abraham. And Reuel was a son of Esau, name of a son of Esau. So there are definite referrals back to the earlier patriarchs, and also Esau, who wasn't one of the patriarchs, but became an outsider, who also forgave Jacob for what he did in taking away his birthright. So there's another little subtle message here about the outsider also being a good person. Jethro is technically an insider because he's descended from the patriarchs, but he's also descended from an outsider. And Moses is invited back. Jethro says to his girls, "Why on earth didn't you ask him to come back?" So they go back and fetch Moses, and he starts to work for Jethro as a shepherd. Now, if you think about it, to work as a shepherd employed by someone is a real test of your humility. And I can identify a little bit with this, because when my ex and I emigrated to Montana and we lost our visa and had to come home, I lost everything. I'd been a television director and producer. I'd been wealthy, house owner, lost everything in our exodus to Montana. And when I came back, the only work I could find to start with was to be peeling vegetables in a pub in London. So I remember thinking, my God, I used to be this and now I'm reduced to that. But it was really important for me to experience that huge loss, to be able to rebuild and to be able to trust God to lift me up through it. So Moses works the way Jacob did for Laban, and he marries Jethro's daughter Zipporah, which means bird. And of course, a bird is a species that flies in Berea, in the air of spirit. Now, Moses has a staff. And if we go into the oral tradition about the staff, or the rod, as it's often called in the Hebrew text, you'll see that nearly everybody of significance carries a staff. Well, okay, maybe they wanted it to walk with, maybe it was a shepherd's crook, but there is a significance in it. And also, the staff is quite frequently associated with a sword. Raziel, for example, who is said to be the member of the Cherubim, who are set to guard Eden, the gate of Eden, so that humanity can't come back to the Tree of Life without due reason. But Raziel was also said to hold a flaming sword, but he was also said to hold a book which had the details of how to return to the Tree of Life. Now, in the ancient days, they didn't have books. So we're talking about the oral tradition. So Raziel's sword being a central column aspect, one single thing, is also relevant in the oral tradition as referring to this post or this pillar or this callback to the Tree of Life. And Raziel is said to have had this oral tradition, which he did teach to Adam and Eve, so that humanity could rediscover the Tree of Life while being outside of Eden. The Eve story I told you in the last section, the book by Sir Thomas Malory, we believe, on the Arthurian legends, about how she took a twig from the Tree of Knowledge and planted it outside Eden, which is another way of saying this is the way back. Moses and Zipporah, the oral tradition says very clearly that it was Zipporah that gave Moses his staff. And I'm obliged to Megan Wagner, one of my colleagues in this tradition, whose wonderful book, Staff of Sapphires, is referenced at the end of this section. She's had more access to this aspect part of the oral tradition than I have. And the legend says that Jethro was walking in his garden one day, and he plunged his own staff into the ground, just an ordinary shepherd's staff. And then when he tried to pull it out, he discovered that the staff had transformed into a tree, sprouted roots, and was blooming. And from that time forward, no one could uproot that staff. Nobody worthy was found to pull it out. That's a pattern. You'll spot that in a minute. And it was said that the one who could easily take it would be the one who could receive Jethro's daughter, Zipporah, in marriage, and would also be the Redeemer of Israel. And so the story goes that Moses came to there. He was eager to marry Zipporah, and Moses was therefore challenged to go into Jethro's garden and attempt to uproot the staff or the tree. And all her other suitors had apparently been devoured by that tree. We come into fairy tales there, don't we? But they obviously didn't manage it. Moses went to the tree and easily pulled it out of the ground, thus winning Zipporah's hand in marriage and redeeming this great staff of knowledge and activating his destiny to become the Redeemer of Israel. And that lovely painting on the right by Jane Addams from Halevi's group in London is a representation of what's come to known as the Staff of Sapphires. And the Tree of Life is known as the Staff of Sapphires. The staff is the central column, and the sephirot in blue there are the sapphires that are, and that is the tree that was pulled up by Zipporah and Moses together. Well, he pulled it up, but it was to win her hand. In the book of Jeremiah, which laments the loss of the first temple, there are many, many references to poles. And they're often referred to as trees or almond trees. And these poles are the trees of the Asherim, the representations of the divine feminine. Ashrata was one of the names that referred to her in the Hebrew. So the almond tree is another callback to the Tree of Life. The word netzer, which is referred to in the book of Isaiah, means root or a rod out of the... Isaiah 11:1 is often quoted coming up to Christmas. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, who is the father of David, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And that was the netzer. A lot of people took that to mean Nazareth. They've translated it as Jesus coming from Nazareth means that he's the netzer. And there is quite a lot of evidence from some of the earlier texts of the New Testament that Jesus was never in Nazareth, but Jesus was of the netzer. So Jesus was of the branch of that tree. But it might be both, it might be either, but it's a wonderful play on words there. And in the book of Revelation, there is what's known as, it's translated as a rod of iron. We will be ruled with a rod of iron, which sounds really savage. But if you actually look into the translations and understand that most Bibles came from Jerome's translating of the Greek into Latin, and many of the translations were taken from that, It's just as simple to translate it as a staff of stars. The word in Greek is sidera, and the Latin of sidera is meteorite or metal that comes from the stars. So it's not too big a leap to say that we will be ruled with a staff of stars, and I rather like that quite a lot better. A bishop's crozier is, of course, a representation of this, and Jesus's shepherd's staff. Well, Jesus didn't have a shepherd's staff, but he's often depicted as having it. The tree of life for Jesus was the cross for the crucifixion. But the staff of stars is our way back. Staff of stars is similar to Raziel's sword. And of course, the sword coming out of the stone is primordial in the Arthurian legends. And the Staff of Sapphires is very powerful in C.S. Lewis's Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and its predecessor, The Magician's Nephew, which tells of the creation of Narnia, which also has its own tree of knowledge or tree of life with apples in it. And Diggory, the child who's sent to get the apple, passes the test and brings it back safely instead of running off with it to heal his mother. His mother is healed later, but in a way, better way than she would have been healed if he'd taken her that apple. And the Lion, the Witch and the wardrobe is built from the apple that Diggory took from the world at the end of the lands, and Aslan planted a seed of it in Narnia, and that grew the tree that protected Narnia, which was an Eden, until it was chopped down, which was the time that the White Witch was able to take power. And the wardrobe of the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is said to have been made from the wood of that Narnian tree. So C.S. Lewis knew his stuff. And what's also very interesting about the Narnia stories is they are all based on the planetary aspects. Each one of them has a planetary aspect. There's a wonderful book called Planet Narnia that goes through all of these. And I reread the Narnia books, and Lewis has put in all the colouring and all the aspects that are attributed to certain planets in each of the books. I'm not going to say any more about that, because I hope you'll have the fun of discovering it for yourself if you like those books. But the magic is in there, and this is referring us back to the Tree of Life. And of course, staffs in all sorts of literature and legend. The Norse witches were wand wed or staff carriers. Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings had a staff. And of course, Harry Potter and all the wizards had a wand. And all these things come from the same root. Okay, I'm going to stop the share for a minute just to see if anybody's got any questions.
You use the word Nitsa. I was wondering if it's another pronunciation of Nistar, because the Nistar is the is one of the just men, the 36 just.
Ah.
In relation, is Nistar's relation Nitsa?
That's entirely possible, Bill. I don't know, but thank you. Yes, that's a thing to look at for the future. Bless you, thanks. Anyone else? Nope. Okay, onwards and upwards then. Oh, sorry, Don, yes, go ahead.
I was just saying, thinking, of course, the reference to the central column or spinal, you know, Kundalini type column as well.
Yes.
People refer to that as, and also the shepherd's.
Absolutely. And
top of that is the back of the head going forwards.
Yes, and the caduceus too. The caduceus is fascinating. We'll have a look at that in a minute or two. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So there Moses is, happily married to Zipporah. They have a son called Gershom. Everything's going very nicely, and suddenly this wretched bush pops up. And the burning bush, the bush that was on fire but was not consumed by fire. Now, this is a beautiful telling on the Tree of Life, because the bush fits the tree perfectly. It fits the chakras as well. The divine reveals itself through this, so that's Keter. The bush itself, the revelation of it and the burning of it and the drawing of Moses to it It's a third eye experience. Whether he saw it physically is moot, but he certainly saw it intuitively. So that's the third eye. An angel speaks to him from this. That's the throat chakra, which is art, which is the direct communication down from the Holy One. Most communication from the Holy One does come through angelic words, because they are the ones who are closer to us and more involved with us and can translate, I don't know what you call it, from God. It's a feeling, an emotion, an impulse that comes to us and is translated for us by our guardian angels and our guides. Moses represents the heart at the level of the soul. Pharaoh represents the solar plexus at Tiferet. This is a negative solar plexus of pride. Moses can also be placed at the solar plexus, but I like to put him at the soul. The Israelites and the Egyptians are working from Yesod, the gonadic chakra, because they're still living in their tribal way. And Egypt itself would be Malkut, the base. So that would be the land. So it's lovely to see these patterns affirming themselves all the way through. And through the angel, the Holy One speaks to Moses. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, Elohim called to him out of the midst of the bush. So we've got both of these aspects. Elohim is relevant here. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cries, and I've come down to deliver them. And God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord God, Yahweh, Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, and the Elohim of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation. So it was not just Yahweh. It was the dual aspect of the masculine feminine, the two aspects working together. However, most commentaries tend to think that, well, they tend to say that God is the honorific and Yahweh is the name. But as Bill has reminded us, thank you, Bill, Yahweh is also an honorific. It's not a name, it's a description. The name of God is Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, I am that I am, or I will be that which I will be. But our nickname for God, if you like, is Yahweh Elohim. And we do tend to use Yahweh all the time, which is a basic imbalance. The instruction is quite clear, because both Yahweh, the Lord, and Elohim, God, are speaking to Moses. So the idea is, it's one God, but it has these aspects to it. And the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And Moses replied, a rod. The Lord said, cast it on the ground. He cast it on the ground and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. This is when Moses is starting the but I can't do it job. You're asking too much of me. I can't do this. God is saying, I want you to go to Egypt and free my people. And Moses is going, no. So I love the fact that the caduceus is both a rod and serpents, and this is the healing emblem of all of medicine. So we have a rod being turned into a serpent. So this, in a way, is an antidote to the Eden thing, and it's an honouring of the fact that the serpent is both good and bad. The serpent, the word is arum in Hebrew, and that actually... No, the word serpent is arum. It's called, serpent is described in Genesis as the word arum, which is usually translated as crafty. But it also means subtle, shrewd, sly, sensible, and prudent. And of course, the serpent is everywhere in mythology. We'll go on to that in a moment, but it's very worth mentioning that the serpent is about magic, which means that the serpent can be good or bad. So it's like one of the Titan It's what we do with the serpent. The serpent can be our gut instinct. The serpent can be our intuition. The serpent can be our power. It's incredibly powerful, and it can be used for good or for bad. So the cobra head on the goddess, who's represented by the princess of Egypt, is using her magic, her power, for good. So God is showing Moses that by transforming the rod into a serpent, he can use forms of magic for good. And later we find in the story that Pharaoh's magicians can also turn rods into serpents. So that's another indication of the duality of the serpent. But serpents in creation are everywhere in the creation myths. There's the Hopi snake, youth and the snake girl. There's Ouroboros, the serpent with the tail in its mouth, a symbol of eternity. There's a serpent demon in Egypt, but there's a serpent protector. So that's both sides of the serpent. The Aboriginal people talk of the great rainbow snake that formed the world. And the Duwajeno Indians of California have the serpent whose name I really can't pronounce, Umaihulajawit, living in the ocean until they called into the land, set him on fire, and the serpent's body exploded, showering the earth with knowledge and treasure and songs. And of course, there's Jormungand, the serpent that encircles the world in Norse mythology. So this serpent aspect is basically the power that is available, which can be used for spirit or for destruction. And the Holy One gives Moses three signs of power to give him the authority to go into Egypt and say to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." The first is the staff to the serpent. And then he tells Moses to put his hand inside his tunic, and when it comes out, it's leprous. Well, leprous in Hebrew Testament just means skin disease, so something like eczema or maybe leprous. And then when he puts his hand back in, it's healed. And then he says, if that doesn't convince them, take some water from the river, put it on the land, and it will turn into blood. And of course, this is a harbinger of the first of the curses that fall on Egypt when Pharaoh won't let them go. So you can see all these little patterns that play out very beautifully. And Moses does not want to do it. And oh, I can identify with that. He says, "Oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent. I'm slow of speech. I'm of a slow tongue. Please, no, not me. I can't do it." And the Lord says, well, your brother Aaron can do it because Aaron is articulate. So go and tell Aaron, and Aaron will speak for you. And then Moses just goes, and this is a difficult one to translate. So one of the translations of the newer modern Bibles, which are quite good, this isn't a good news Bible, this actually translates as, "Oh my Lord, send another." And other translations are, "Please Lord, send the agent you will send," which has an implication other than I. And the other is, "Please Lord, now send the message by whomever you will," which also carries the, well, if it has to be me, then so be it, but preferably not, which is, we have echoed in the Garden of Gethsemane for Jesus. If you can take this cup from me, please do, otherwise thy will be done. So we see messianic parallels here, and that's not surprising, because Moses was, in my view, the Messiah of his age. And the next and final thing we have to get to is the fact that the Lord then says, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart." And that sounds frankly mean when you think about it. Moses is going to talk to Pharaoh. There's a nice picture of Yul Brynner there, being a nice mean Pharaoh. Why would the Lord need to harden Pharaoh's heart? And again, we have to go into the mystical teaching and go into the Tree of Life to look at why this would be. Now, to start with, Pharaoh's heart is hardened by himself. Therefore, Pharaoh hardens his heart at 8:15 and 8:32 in Exodus. And by hardening your heart, which is the soul, marked here in the pale gold again, what you are doing is you are blocking off spirit and focusing on your power in the world below. So Pharaoh has hardened his heart and cut off the link there, which is, I put the star there, which is the da'at, or the cap flap, if you like, from Yetzirah, the psyche, into Berea. Each of the worlds has its own cap flap, which moves through to the foundation of the next world up. So this starred area for us is whether or not we're going to open up to our intuition. But it's also the yesod, the foundation of Berea. So whatever we place here or don't place here is the foundation of what spirit can reveal to us. So if we harden our hearts, this area is hardened, therefore God won't get through. So if Pharaoh hardens his heart, God has very little choice but to maintain that hardened heart, because it is Pharaoh's free will. Now, hopefully that makes sense to you. If you harden your heart, you instruct spirit to give you hard-hearted experiences. It's called resonance. What you resonate with, you attract. Or the, in the modern world, of course, the law of attraction. So we've got all this flow of Kabbalah already coming through this story, and we haven't even got to the other aspects yet. And finally, there's this odd little bit that says the Lord tries to kill Moses on the way. He goes back to Zipporah and says, we're going to Egypt. This is my work. And Zipporah packs up the child, maybe other children. We don't know how old Gershom is at this point, but he won't be a baby. And it's not clear in the text who the Lord tries to kill. It's assumed that it's Moses, but it just refers to he. It says the Lord tries to kill him. And the response to this comes from Zipporah, who circumcises the child, and the Lord backs away. So there's oodles of stuff in there to work through. Gershom is the firstborn of Moses, and we know that child sacrifice happened, and we know that the Lord has already threatened. It's in Exodus. He does say to Moses that he will kill the firstborn of Egypt if Pharaoh won't let the Israelites free. And he has said that Pharaoh's heart is hardened and he will harden it. Therefore, the firstborn are going to be killed. Now, one of the interpretations of this could easily be that Moses is worried so much about the killing of the firstborn, but by resonance, he draws a dangerous situation. And Zipporah and the circumcision is the way of ensuring that Gershom has the ritual of humility, of humiliation that a man needs. There must be some form of ritual of manhood, of growing to manhood, in order to substitute the death of the firstborn for the blood of the youngster. And of course, we have the parallel of the blood of the lamb, the perfect lamb for Passover. Now, if it's the Lord trying to kill Moses, well, fair enough, that's possible. It wouldn't necessarily be the Lord trying to kill him, actually, as an external thing. It's Moses' desire to walk away from the work. And if you have become a part of the work, if you have committed yourself to it, and I'm not saying that any of you have, but I know that I have, I can't walk away from this work now, or I would be committing spiritual suicide. You can't go back after a certain point. And if Moses was reluctant and considering turning back and saying, I can't do it, he would have been cutting off his link to the Holy One, which is a spiritual death. So it's entirely possible that this is a slightly clumsy telling of how Moses was trying to resist this incredibly difficult and terrifying work that he'd been asked to do. I mean, he hasn't even told Aaron yet what he's got to do, and he's going to need Aaron's backup hugely. He hasn't told Miriam, hasn't told his parents, hasn't got a coterie, hasn't got his 30 33 good men, or 32 good men, sorry, I got that wrong, to back him up, he's bound to be terrified. So I think this is an analogy about the importance of, once you have said, yes, I will do it, of committing to the path. If you don't commit to the path, there is a consequence. At the time I'm speaking, there's all this furore about the release of the draft proposal at the American Supreme Court to repeal Wade versus Roe. And this aspect of repealing something, I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought there. What was I going to say about that? Nope, I've completely forgotten it. I should probably have to delete that bit. I do apologise. If I come back to it later, I'll record it and throw it in. But my brain's just gone completely fried at that point. Trust me to go off on a side thing. Let me have a think for a moment. What was that about? Nope, can't get it. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, well. So, that's it for today. Thank you very much. I want to put an accreditation up. Kabbalah and Exodus by Halevi is excellent. The Hidden Tradition of the Kingdom of God is this wonderful beginning unravelling by Dr. Margaret Barker of the Secrets of the First Temple. And Megan Wagner's Sapphire Staff is also superb. It's very deeply psychological. Megan is a true priestess in this tradition. And next time, we're going to be talking about the 10 plagues when Moses goes back to Pharaoh. So there we are. Any thoughts, comments, questions? Yes, Bill? You have to unmute yourself again.
I'm not quite sure whether I mentioned it last time, but the bit about the Pharaoh, for those who do not know Joseph, pardon me for repeating something I've already said before, the whole point was that there was a change, two changes of pharaonic regime in Egypt. Originally, they were an African pharaohs. Then I think it was the Hittites invaded and put their own pharaoh in. And the Hittites were a Semitic people. So when Jacob came to Egypt, he came to a people who were sort of racially related. Then the Africans invaded back again and became the pharaohs. And of course, Hittites were driven out. The Hebrews remained, but the Africans were very, very scared that the Hittites might make another invasion, in which case they knew that the Israelites would support them, being of similar stock. Therefore, they were virtually regarded by the Egyptians as a fifth column in Egypt and had to be kept under control.
That makes a lot of logical sense, Bill. Thank you. Yes. Okay, any more thoughts, comments, questions? No? Can you see how it's your personal story? Yes, Elise. Would you unmute yourself?
I just wondered if you could say a little bit more about that last bit, saying that once you've got to a certain point in the work, you can't go back. And I immediately got me thinking, I feel like I'm at the very start of a path, and I can remember you saying previous, I feel like I've had lots of direction from the universe to start me in this path. And I can remember you saying in the past that the third time the universe sends you a message, it usually comes with a brick attached, which I relate to. And I'm, of course, thinking about the free will as well.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
I do see what you're saying. We only have limited free will. We talk about free will a lot, but every decision we make changes what we can do. For example, I can never be a ballet dancer now, and I'm not going to be a Formula One driver. for many, many reasons. But when I was younger, I made the choices. Well, I couldn't have been a Formula One driver back then. But of course, when I was a girl, I couldn't have been a minister either. It wasn't permitted. But your choices cut some aspects off and add some aspects on. So when you get into spiritual work, you are starting to cut off some aspects of your life, which would include stealing, you know, breaking the commandments. They would preclude all these things because they are directly contrary to it. When you live in society and its addictive aspects, there's, I was talking to my brother on the phone today. Our landlord from our previous home hasn't moved into the house yet. He's completely abandoned it for the last 6 months, which breaks my heart because it had a beautiful garden. And been a few times I've gone into that garden because it has a front gate. And frankly, I've nicked some of the stuff from my old vegetable patch because it's just sitting there. But technically, that's sort of dishonest. And I still had to, before I did it, I had to say to God, is it okay? Will you give me a sign as to whether this I can go in and do this? Because technically it isn't mine. And the next time I went past the house, the gate was open. And the guy locks it, you see. So he'd forgotten to lock it and the gate was open. So I got the sign to do it. And that's the kind of thing that you have to listen for. You have to use your free will to say, okay, I can go and take my broccoli, my purple sprouting broccoli, which is looking very nice now, thank you, or I cannot. And then once the spiritual seeker gets to the point where you go, well, I'm not going to make this decision because at one level it's right and at one level it's wrong. I'm going to ask above. So once you've got to that, there's a sort of different essence to your life. And of course, you will fall flat on your face occasionally and forget to do it. But it comes so that you cannot get away with things. You can't get away with things that you could perhaps have got away with before because you're trying to hone your soul to be focused in on the Holy One. And there comes a point such as it should be something like ordination. When I was ordained, there was this moment when my bishop anointed my hands and he says, those whom these hands bless remain blessed. Those who these hands do not bless remain unblessed. And just suddenly this whole shaft of something came down my spine and said, this is the responsibility you have taken on.
Wow.
If you don't bless people in your presence, they are remaining unblessed. So that's the kind of huge thing. So you realize that you have this responsibility. So my job is to bless. I pray every night for Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, all the people I don't necessarily yes or approve of. But it's my work. So that's taken away. I have still got the free will of not doing it, of cursing them. But if I do that, I'm literally cutting off my point through to art, because right now the point through to art has to be more important to me than anything else. And it's only when you get to that level, when you have done the equivalent of the sacrament of ordination, which is say, I will lie down on the floor in a church in the cross position and say, my life is yours. From that point, you've stymied a lot of your free will, and if you turn back, you are breaking a big, big vow. Yes, I finally remembered the bit about the Supreme Court. And guess what? It's not actually about the Supreme Court at all. It's about abortion, which is why I was thinking of it. I am totally pro-choice. I am absolutely convinced that the soul does not enter the body of the child until the birth, the first breath. It's around, it's involved, but it has its own free will to come in or not. And quite often a soul will decide it's not willing to do this lifetime, and that would mean a miscarriage. And sometimes the mother is going to have an abortion, so the soul will withdraw. And I have definite evidence in the counselling processing I've done over the years of women who've had abortions, and that soul has come back later when they were able to have a child in safety. So the soul is not the issue in abortion. But when a woman gets pregnant and terminates the pregnancy, she is breaking a law, and it has karmic consequences for her. So having an abortion is not a good idea if you can possibly avoid it. If you can't avoid it, then go ahead by all means. You won't hurt the soul, but you have turned back on a process of creation, and it may very well impact you psychologically for quite some time. So that was all I wanted to say about that, but I still am pro-choice, but I know there are consequences. Choice equals consequence. So there we are. That's your session for this evening. Thank you so much, and goodbye and God bless, and I'll see you next week.